Guard our minds and our hearts. Help us to be enlightened to the things that we learn. Let us leave here more confident in you and who you are and your presence in our life. Lord, let this philosophical theology that we do today become a very real theology in our life. Lord, we do love you. This is the reason why we do these things. And so just bless each individual here, including Rome and I, as we teach through this subject. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Okay, what we want to do is we want to dive right into this today. I want you to ask this question. Last week we ended by saying that the study of the existence of God was just as important for believers as it is non-believers, because everybody sitting here does not have perfect faith. What I want to start this class by asking each one of you is to think through the existence of God and say, put yourself in a position of someone who doubts his existence. Or better yet, come up with issues that have caused you in the past or in the present to stop and say, gosh, God, are you really there? I don't ask you directly. I assume that everybody does go through those struggles at one time or another. If you don't, you're very rare. It's the foundation of who we are. And sometimes you stop and you state, is it really true? Tell me some of the things that would cause you, or you have seen people, the reasons why they would doubt the existence of God. Okay, can't see them. Can't see them. Most things we believe in, we see. Right? So the problem of evil. Problem of evil. And it's not only the problem of evil, it's the problem of evil plus God being good. Correlating with secular teaching. It's a very common cause for the doubt of God's existence. And really what it is you're saying, if this many smart people who have studied these issues don't come to the conclusions that I do, maybe they're more objective than I am. Maybe I pursue these things because I want to, and the more objective data suggests that he is not around because we can't see him. And so it's the idea that you're doubting his existence based upon what characteristics his existence implies in your mind at that point. And so you doubt the formation of God that you have created in your mind. If it's the all-powerful being, if it's the one who's in control of all things, if it's the one who is, as we have said, above the arch, it almost sometimes seems like fantasy. We live in a succession of moments. We're talking about a God that doesn't. We live in a succession of moments where we see things, where we touch things, where we hear things, where we interact. And God seems to be absent from those arenas. So sometimes we choose not to believe based upon our desire to sin and our desire not to be exposed or accountable to some type of higher being. And if we take that which is above the arch away, then suddenly we're not accountable to anybody or anything, are we? Because there's nothing timeless. There's no principle that is exerting itself over us. Therefore, there's no principles of truth or morals. No judgment. Because what are you going to be judged upon if there's no above the arch? I mean, above a judgment in itself,
begs the question. That's not good.
It's something else. It requires above the arch. It presupposes, that's what I was looking for, presupposes above the arch, because otherwise there's no such thing as judgment. And some of these people I read about a lot of times, that's from what they've gone through. They've just prayed to God so much, and finally they realize that he's just not there because of they've been asking him. If he's really there, show some type of sign or something. It's such a common thing. And if we're all honest, that's one of the issues that we all struggle with. How do we deal with God in this idea of his response to us? And sometimes his hiddenness, a divine hiddenness is what we would call it. Why is he so hidden?
That's more the idea of moving back towards deism. Not denying God exists, but just not seeing him interact in our world. Praying over and over and over for the Lord to act in some way and just not seeing it. You see that throughout the scripture as well. Times in Job, for example, where are you, God? Why aren't you here?
sometimes the meaninglessness of things. Sometimes things that happen just kind of haphazardly. Things that don't seem to have any meaning. Why did this happen? It has no relevance in the big picture of things, God. Why would you allow this? And then all of a sudden you start thinking, things are just happening. There's no God up there controlling it. It's, you know, I get out and I do certain things that, you know, I have a minor car accident. Why? What is that? How does that play into the big picture of things? I do something stupid at work and make a stupid mistake. Why? You know, why does all these little things have to happen? And we want to see God working and we want to be able to see the way it works. And sometimes the meaninglessness of it all just kind of sets in and you state, where's God in all of this? And people will sometimes go further and further away from their belief in God while their confession stays. And maybe even their prayer life sometimes stays, but their heart is moving away because their intellect has moved away. And so their confession stays, but they really aren't believing like they used to. And what we'd say is the belief in God is very basic to the Christian life. And a strong belief in God is very basic to our sanctification. And we don't just believe in God and then we build on top of that. Our belief in God strengthens and grows throughout our Christian life. Our true belief that He is there, it's not as if you believe and that you're 100% or you're 0%. There's variations in between that help us to grow in the Christian life. Let me ask you this question now. Thank you for being very honest about those struggles. They're very real struggles. Let me run through some of these. I can't see or hear them. My experience does not affirm Him. It's too good to be true. I mean, every one of these we've said. Mm-hmm. I can't comprehend an eternal being. There are too many different views about Him. I can't understand why He would allow so much suffering. So, just exactly what you all said. Why are people, or why are you in particular, confident about His existence? What makes you confident about His existence? So now experience on one side may cause people to doubt it, but sometimes experience causes you to affirm His existence, right? This is the same argument that a lot of scientists, you know, who have turned to God would come to and say, well, once it comes down to it, there's this idea of irreducible complexity, and that we are too complex, we are too structured, and you cannot argue anything. Evolution cannot explain our complexity. It cannot explain the structure. And so therefore, there has to be a designer. It's kind of the idea of if there's a design, there has to be a designer. The rebuilding, okay, good.
The World War II.
Good. Very good example. And that's a historical example that would say that God is at work in history, and I see that work in history, therefore I believe in Him. Which really, whenever it comes down to it, is one of the things that God calls on the Israelites to do. Remember my work in history. Anytime they have some type of doubts, anytime they're getting ready to turn to other gods, what did they do for you? And what did I do for you? Remember history. So historical events, very good. What else? Certainly we would say we couldn't create it. You're getting to a very good point, though. The mass of the universe demands something behind it. It's not only what you're saying is the design of it, we've already just talked about that, but it's just its very existence, right? I mean, how can you explain the existence of anything outside of who and what God is? How can you explain the existence of below the arch if there's no above the arch? That's kind of another way to put it, you know, the way we've been going through it.
Answered prayers.
Answered prayers. Good. So another very much experiential point that would say that my experience has confirmed the reality of God in my life. And I would do that too sometimes. How many of you have hallmarks in your life that you think of whenever you start to doubt God? And oh, yeah. I mean, all of a sudden that hallmark solidifies again. How many of you? Yeah, a lot of you. Good. Again, a lot of this, like you said, is very subjective. A lot of people would say, based upon your subjectivity, you can't be true because your subjectivity only takes you so far. We need some more objective data. Objective data such as the design theory or how do we explain everything based upon how do we explain below the arch without above the arch, that sort of stuff. But whenever it comes down to it personally, everybody here would say that there's some very real subjective stuff in your life, experiences that really confirm God's existence. What happens whenever God's existence is only based upon those things, though? Say you prayed to Him and he saved your son or your daughter from something or healed them of cancer. What's the problem of basing your belief of existence of God on that? I mean, gosh, 2 weeks later, you've seen it happen before. I've seen God praised for things that a week later, it's just like, where'd he go? You know, everybody's saying, what a miracle, what a miracle. And the cancer's all gone. And then a week later, the guy's dead. And you're just like, oh, I guess he never was there. It's kind of, well, why the meaninglessness of that? So you go back and forth with those types of things. Not saying they're not real, not saying that we shouldn't look to those types of things. But throughout history, as we look at these arguments for the existence of God, I'm not going to give the argument that you have in your experience. I can't give that. But we can look through some of the objective things. And then on top of those objective things comes in your real experience with God. But a lot of people have the experience of not having God. And they'd say, whenever I prayed for this, he wasn't there. Whenever I looked for him, I couldn't find him. How many people know people who say, I just have looked for him, but he doesn't show himself, therefore he's not there? Yeah. Answers to this is the most basic philosophical question. Why is there something more than that? Where did everything come from? You know, this massive universe. The design of the universe, as Mike said. Design. The majority of the world is on my side. The idea is if 90% or 95% of the world has always believed in God, well, you know, maybe they are right. Maybe there's something to this God thing. Lack of any other adequate explanation, really, for existence. The universal concept of morality and aesthetics. The idea whenever you look at something and you say, this is right or this is wrong. If it's universally accepted as such, there is such a thing as right or wrong, at that point, you're automatically saying there isn't above the arch. Otherwise, it's not a universal right or wrong. Because universals can only happen above the arch. They can't happen below the arch. So therefore, whenever people say, gosh, I think that torturing innocent babies for fun is wrong, automatically you're implying some type of above the arch, no matter what. You're not saying, I think it's wrong for today in our society. Most people who advocate that say it's always wrong. It's never been right, never will be right. Well, in order to do that, you have to have it above the arch. You have to. Because otherwise, it's below the arch and relative.
I understand the concept of morality. What about aesthetics?
Beauty. Whenever you say, whenever everybody looks at the sunset and sees it going down, you say, you know, that's beautiful. There's a universal aesthetics to creation. So that's one reason why people would say that. And then another one, the Bible says so. You look at the Bible and see the history of the Bible. See the resurrection of Christ. And once you have seen the historical resurrection of Christ, you cannot deny that there's a God, which is a very good one as well. Let's ask this question. I want you all to help me out here. Why is there something rather than nothing? Give me all the possible explanations that could ever be given to this question. It's been called the most basic philosophical question that can ever be asked. Tell me, run the gamut of the different options for this question. Answers. Why is there something rather than nothing? Okay. There's always been something. There was never nothing. So it's the eternity of the universe idea. Far back in time as you can go, there was always something. Okay, God created it. It's a good theory. That is an option, of course. There's a self-existent being who created all that there is.
Think of the question this way. What else could have created something, i.e. created the universe? Not necessarily what you believe, but what are the possible answers to that question? We said it's always been in existence, so it never had a creation point. We've said that God could be its creator, an eternal self-existent being created it. What other ways could we go about answering why is there something? Why is there a universe? Why is there stuff rather than no stuff? It was created by what?
Big Bang. Are we talking about one specific?
Yeah. What's the key? What's the buzzword that is used around Big Bang theory ideas? No, I'm not saying anything against the Big Bang, but this buzzword. It was created. Why did the Big Bang happen? By chance.
By chance.
And so you hear that quite a lot. Everything was created by chance.
Since
That's right.
Very good.
Everything's
there is nothing.
An illusion. There is nothing.
Whose illusion?
Everything that's out there is not really there, therefore there is nothing to be created. Why is there something rather than nothing? There really isn't. You're in an illusion. So really, whenever we look at this from most philosophical theologians or philosophers in general throughout history have stated these are the only options. There are no other options besides these. There is nothing. All is an illusion. The universe is self-created. The universe is created by chance. The universe is created by nothing. The universe has existed for eternity, or a self-existent God created the universe. No other options. Nothing else. Unless you can come up with one. Now, the universal axiom is that once you narrow down all of the options to the final one, as long as you have all the options represented, then the final one is what? Truth. And so what we're going to do is kind of walk through the existence of God based upon this question. All of the options to why is there something rather than nothing?
Again, this is not a Christian question. This is just a philosophical question. Why something rather than nothing? And these are all that you can read through all the German, all the liberal philosophers. You can go through Kierkegaard. You can go through everyone. And these are all the options that have ever come up with.
It's only true to the degree that the premise is true. Here's an example. I think I said this before. All men are mortal. Rome is a man, therefore Rome is mortal. That is only true to the degree that all men are mortal. This is only true to the degree that we have all of the options represented. And so the challenge is always out there to anyone who disbelieves in God to say, which one of these do you opt for? And if none of them, then which one do you go for? When all of the options have been deduced, the one remaining option is right. So we start with the first one. There is nothing. All is an illusion. Okay, tell me about this one. That's right. It's very self-defeating. The moment you say that all is an illusion, you have an illusion. An illusion is something. And you are the producer of that illusion. And where did the producer of the illusion come from? Or where did the illusion itself come from? I mean, you still have the question to answer. Descartes dealt with this very idea. He said, maybe there is a pack of demons that is messing with my mind, making me think that all things that I see are real. But then whenever it comes down to it, you've got to deal with the demons, and then you've got to deal with your thinking. And therefore, he came to the conclusion and said, well, if I'm thinking, that is the very foundation to my being. I think, therefore I am. Therefore, it can't be an illusion. There's got to be some other explanation beyond illusion. If it is an illusion, where did the illusion come from? If it is an illusion, does that say twice?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then he goes on and on. If that is an illusion, if you're losing an illusion, then it just goes on and on forever and doesn't ever solve any problem. It's called an argument ad infinitum, which throws it into infinity, and therefore it's never dealing with the real issue. It's just throwing it into infinity. Second one is the universe is self-created. Tell me about this one. Quantum physics actually today is going in this direction to some degree. Quantum physics is denying to some degree, and then believe me, I don't want to get into a debate about quantum physics because it's a theory that is in flux right now a lot. But the idea is that the cause and effect, this is what it would be, deal with, cause and effect, every effect has a cause, is being challenged again today. And quantum physics would say that whenever we look at the atom, whenever we look at it at its most basic molecular structure, we don't see a cause and effect ratio. We see disappearance of things and appearance of things. And have you ever seen that movie? What's that movie that did you go see it with me?
Yeah,
What the Bleep Do You Know?
Oh.
What the Bleep Do You Know? It's a movie that's an independent film movie talking about postmodernism and quantum mechanics and the idea that all things exist, but they pop into existence and out of existence. There's no cause and effect. And this theory would say the universe is self-created. The idea that it just popped into existence, created itself. It is its own first cause. But the problem we would say is that, I mean, most basically, I mean, no matter what quantum mechanics tells us, you cannot base your assumption and deny the law of cause and effect based upon an assumption of a theory that is certainly not agreed upon in quantum physics, quantum mechanics. Something could not create itself since it would have to predate itself to create itself. This is a logical contradiction and therefore absurd. It's again self-defeating. So two of them have defeated themselves. The very statements defeat themselves. In order to create itself, it has to predate itself. In order to predate itself, it has to be created. And again, ad infinitum. It just goes on. And it's an argument of fallacy that just wouldn't work. How about this one? The universe was created by chance. Well, let me ask you this. What do we say? The universe is created by chance. Substitute chance for something else. The universe is created by... Say something.
God.
Okay. Universe is created by mind. Universe is created by an angel. Okay. Tell me the difference whenever you put an agent of the activity of creation, because we've got created by, which is an active verb. The subject is chance. Tell me the difference between Mike, God, and angels and chance.
Accountability.
Okay. The arch. Chance is just a mathematical term. It's not an agent that can do anything. It has no being. It's a descriptive term, but it has no being in itself. I think R.C. Sproul dealing with this, he spends a whole book dealing with this, just trying to get people's minds straight about the way they talk about things. But he says, sophisticated arguments are put forth of chance creation, have been formulated, which dazzle the mathematical comprehension. What are the real chances of the universe being created by chance? Not a chance. Chance is incapable of creating a single molecule, let alone an entire universe. Why not? This is key, because chance is a no thing. It is not an entity. It has no being, no power, no force. It can affect nothing because it has no causal power. It can't be the agent of a cause. How does this happen? He says, it is a word that is inserted into our pop culture and into Nova channels and such as that. It is a word which describes mathematical possibilities which, by the curious flip of the fallacy of ambiguity, underline that, the fallacy of ambiguity, slips into the discussion as if it were a real entity with real power, indeed supreme power, the power of creativity. I think it describes it very well. I mean, all of a sudden you throw a word in there and it's used enough, said enough, all of a sudden, a word has causal power, and we let people get by with it. How could you ever get by with this in any other arena in life? But whenever it comes to the most important question in the world, you can, by a curious flip of the fallacy of ambiguity, making chance mean something that it never means in any other context. All of a sudden, it has power. All of a sudden, it is a being. All of a sudden, it has ultimate power of creativity. The universe is created by chance. And so, I know that's, you know, you push somebody in the corner and you say, wait a minute, it doesn't have any being. Most people would understand that, but it's just promoted in such a way. And then you forget to think it through. So, can chance create the universe? Is this a real option? No, it's not an option. It's a fallacious option. It's not a real option. Universe is created by nothing. That's the next option. But this violates the law of causality. There must be a cause to every effect. And this also has to do with the self-creation. Sometimes people put those two together and see this as really one. There must be a cause to every effect. There's no possibility of a causeless effect. We cannot go in those directions and say, yes, there's... I mean, just think if your house happened to catch fire and burn down, and the police come over, and the investigators, and the fire department, they say, we're going to try to figure out the cause for this fire. You know, don't bother, there was no cause. They say, no, well, it started somewhere. No, it didn't start anywhere. Well, there was something that caused this to... No, there was nothing. It was just there. There was never any cause at all. You say, well, that's pretty crazy. Everything you do in life assumes that there was a cause behind that. And to not assume so, we would say that violates the law of causality. There's an old saying from philosophy, it refers, ex nihilo nihil fit. Out of nothing, nothing comes. No such thing as saying that something can be created out of nothing. It's absurd. Again, it's self-defeating. Because something, if it was created out of nothing, you're giving nothing causal power. It's, again, a flip of ambiguity. Now, you can either put chance there or put nothing there, but neither one of those has any causal power, so therefore, it's really a non-argument. It's a way to get by the argument without having a real argument. But just notice how difficult it is to come up with arguments against God's existence. We have found no valid arguments whatsoever. All of them have been self-defeating up to this point. All of them. So therefore, they've all canceled themselves out. How about this one? The universe, Carl Sagan says, is all there is, all there was, and all there ever will be. He said the universe has been existing for eternity. Talk to me about this.
What happened a minute before that?
There was no minute before. Go back as far as we can, and there's always going to be plenty of minutes before. It's always been. Sometimes referred to as the steady state theory, oscillating universe theory, the idea that there's been many big bangs, we're just in one of them, and you go back, you know, no matter how far you go back, and we're still in the same process. Whatever that process may be, we can come up with all kinds of theories about it, but, and even if you go up with all kinds of theories about the steady state of time, you still say that this is all there has ever been. We can go back into eternity and it will still be. So there's no creation. Maybe there's some type, like the oscillating universe, big bang, bang, and then it pulls back. Bang, then it pulls back. In a way you could, I guess, but again, our definition of God is that which is above the arch. And they would just say, all that's ever existed is below the arch, and it has always existed. Time has always been, in one form or another, and it has just always existed that way. There's never been anything from the outside that produces the below the arch. Yeah, there's no assumption that it had to come into existence ever. But you're getting somewhere. I know where you're going. You're just having trouble right now articulating it. And I know where you're going. I'm trying to draw it out of you. Each one of the theories so far has proved itself to be what's called analytically false. False by definition. Self-defeating. Just like the statement of a triangle has four sides is analytically false. Each one of the other ones has been false by definition. There's no arguing past unless you go into a whole different realm of existence or something. But in our world, it can't be true. Now, how is this one in the same realm? This one as well is self-defeating. It is an impossibility, is what we would say. It's not just an unlikelihood, not just a low chance of it, but it's an impossibility for some reason, and you just about got there. I want you all to struggle with this one. That's just not as if you haven't been struggling with these others. This one is very important. An infinite number of moments cannot be traversed. How come an infinite? Why would philosophers state that an infinite number of moments cannot be traversed? Infinity, by definition, can't be reached. I mean, that's the very word. That's what it means. Of course, it is impossible to have an infinite series of cause and effects. Infinite is a theoretical term that doesn't exist in time. And if you have eternity going back to infinity, never having a beginning, you have an infinite. Now, hang with me for a moment, okay? This is very difficult. It's called the Kalam, cosmological argument for the existence of God. And the idea here is that if we were ever at point A, where we're at right now, we would have to cross an infinite number of moments to get here. The idea here is that if you have an infinity of anything, you cannot traverse it by definition. If we are at point A, if we ever get to this point, then it means that we have crossed an infinite number of moments to get here, correct? The idea that the universe was never created, right, would say that no matter how far you go back, you will never be able to find the beginning point, right? There's never been a beginning. That's the assumption behind the universe is eternal. It's because there's never a beginning point. If there's never a beginning point, then this theory would say that we can never come to the present point. Why? Because incomplete infinites are not possible. Hang with me. Let me jump one ahead to this. If a man were to try to jump out of an infinitely deep hole, when would he come out? Never. Why?
Because there's no starting point. It's the same thing as saying, if we were to ever get to the present moment, when would we get here? If the universe is infinite, when would we be here?
Now.
Never.
We're here now.
We could never get to the present moment as if, just like this guy, could never get out of the hole. Is everybody hanging with me? You cannot traverse an infinite number of moments. If you have to go back eternity, and you can never get there, if you can never get to the beginning, then you could never get to the present, because an infinite number of moments would have to be traversed. First begun, well, I mean, this goes back very far into philosophical history, but as far as the church is concerned, St. Thomas Aquinas is the first one who really articulated this for the Christian. It had been articulated for quite some time by the Islam community. Islamic, the word kalam, which is, I think, the word source, is that right?
Speech.
And what it would state is these three are the only possibilities. You cannot have an infinite time stretching both past and future. That's an impossibility. Because you can never have a present. You cannot have an infinite time stretching all the way back into the past. The only possibility is to have a beginning point. All time requires a beginning point if you exist within the time and if you're experiencing one present moment. William Lane Craig has written probably the most definitive book on this in philosophy. Ronald Nash, Norman Geisler, just about every theologian who tries to get their arms around this and tries to... Usually you don't see this taught in public circles too much because it's a very difficult concept to understand. It is impossible to have an infinite series of cause and effects. Incomplete infinites are not possible because an infinite, by definition, is complete. If the universe were made up of an infinite number of effects stretching into the past, we could never come to the present effect since we'd have to traverse an infinite number of effects to get to the present effect. And we can't traverse an infinite. So, having gone through the first five, this is what most philosophers, Christian philosophers, would say, is you can narrow it down and say the only option is number six. Because all other options, by definition, have been self-defeated. They're all self-defeating. Therefore, R.C. Sproul would say that if something exists, there is a God. If you can really say that something exists, the only option is there is a God, because everything else has self-defeated, self-destructed. It is false by the very nature of its own arguments. So that's why we would say if you cannot come up with any other arguments besides these, then there is a God, period. Now here's the deal, that whenever you're arguing it this way, what we've done is we've tried to take the existence of God, be very objective about it. R.C. Sproul himself would say that you can know for certain. It's called classical apologetics. You can use this argument and know without a doubt, because the premises are exhausted, that there is a God. Now, other people would approach it and say, well, there's always the option that there is one more possibility, that there's something else out there we haven't looked at. Now, I'm not one who says that we have to be able to argue for the existence of God and come up with 100% certainty. Just like I said before, if all the evidence is pointing towards it, then we are morally obligated to act upon the evidences. We don't act only once we have 100% certainty. Although there are some people who would say this argument and the argument, what we'll talk about in just a moment, the ontological argument and the cosmological argument, all provide absolute certainty. So we'll have to look at each one of those now. These are the five different, or the six different arguments, traditional arguments for the existence of God, and then there's a final cumulative case, which we'll say is a kind of a summary of them all. But the five different arguments, we're going to go through these each briefly. The first one is called the cosmological argument for the existence of God. Does anybody know what the cosmological argument is? Anybody ever heard of it? Can you kind of give me a brief summary of what it is? The cosmological argument most basically is this. There must be a cause for every effect, therefore God must be that cause. It's the idea of going back, and if you agree with the law of causality, you would say, can you go back infinity And we'd say, of course not. So the law of cause and effect would say that you cannot go back infinity, same thing as before, the Kalam cosmological argument is what we said before. You cannot go back infinity. You have to have a starting point. Syllogism number one, every effect has a cause. So if you start with that premise, then you say the universe is an effect. And then number three, there cannot be an infinite regress of cause and effects. Where might someone poke holes in this argument? Number one or number two premise? The universe is an effect, okay? The only other option would be the universe is not an effect. The universe is eternal, right? It's not an effect of anything. So in order to subscribe to, or challenge number two, you would have to deny that an infinite series of events or moments cannot be traversed. There must be an uncaused cause. Syllogism number two, everything that moves must have a mover. The universe is moving. Therefore, there cannot be an infinite regress of cause and effects. Therefore, there must be an unmoved mover. So another way of stating the same thing. And then the Kalam, which we talked about beforehand, is that everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe obviously began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Now, I know that some of these, let me back up just for a minute. I know that some of these are, you're saying, why are we learning all of these? One of the reasons why we're learning these is because they're rich in our theological history. It's very important for us to at least be exposed to. It may not be the primary argument you use for the existence of God. It's not necessarily the primary argument Rome uses, probably not the primary argument that you use, and not the argument that I use. But it's important for us to grapple with these things and understand how they contribute to our knowledge of the existence of God. Now, whenever it comes down to the people who are more mathematically minded, these things are very effective. The ontological argument. This one's a real fun one. This is an argument from the necessary existence. Now listen to this. Anselm of Canterbury. Let me tell you the story about this one beforehand. Anselm in the 11th century was asked by the church to come up with an argument for the existence of God which was so simple that anybody could grasp, right? And that it was self-evident, that had no holes, that was 100% certain, absolute certainty tied to this. And so this is what he came up with. So this is the argument for just the normal, everyday lay person.
Good introduction.
Premise one, if God exists, we must conceive of him as a necessary being. But by definition, a necessary being cannot not exist. Okay, you hanging with me? Therefore, a necessary being must exist. That's it. Let's put it another way. If God exists, we must conceive of him as the greatest conceivable being. But by definition, listen to this, okay? If God exists, you've got to conceive of him as the greatest conceivable being. But by definition, the greatest conceivable being must exist, or we would not be the greatest conceivable being, since one could conceive of something greater than him, namely one that exists. What? Would you all say that existence is greater than non-existence? Okay. So in Anselm's mind, if you thought of the greatest conceivable being, he must exist. Because if he's not existing, he's not the greatest conceivable being. Now this is such an interesting argument because the history on this is so rich. The idea here that we have to see is that in theological history, this is used quite a bit. And whenever you come to some of the real key theologians and philosophers today, that this is really resurfacing quite a bit. People are saying that while most people can't grab a hold of this, this is an airtight case. Now, I wish Rome or I could tell you.
This is the hardest one that we've had, even doing the readings on this. It's just so difficult to try and understand. I understand it comes at a point in history where they're trying to deal with what could be absolute. There's an issue of absolutes here and this idea of airtightness. This is in an age, we live in a different era now, before the scientific method was triumphed. And so it's even in its as this is being developed, it's putting a trust in something that people aren't familiar with. So it's very hard to deal with, but basically all it is it's just saying, and Michael, I think you were getting at the key point, which is whatever we can conceive of can you one-up it somehow? And then if you can one-up it, I would, you know, you see this in children, well, my yard is this big. Well, my yard is, you know, twice as big. And you go bigger and bigger and bigger. When you get to the top, whenever that is, when you couldn't conceive of anything better than the very highest thing you conceive of, that, if you will, by definition, is what God would have to be. God would have to be the highest level of conception. Think of whatever you can think of. If you can think of something better, then you haven't thought of God yet. You've thought of something, but it's not quite at God. And that's that idea. It's so interesting because philosophically, they weren't playing with stuff like this mathematically at this point. They were dealing with it on a philosophical basis. That was the challenge.
One of the things that we could rephrase this and help us to better understand is maybe we could say this. If God exists, we must conceive of him as the one who is above the arch. We've already defined that, because otherwise it's not really God that we're defining. God is by definition that which is above the arch. Everybody hanging with me there? But by definition, that which is above the arch must exist, or he would not be above the arch. That's the idea. That's what Anselm was getting at. Since one could conceive of something that is greater, namely that which is above the arch. And so the idea is, if you take the arch, you can help see where Anselm is going. He argues for the existence of God based upon what's called the necessary being. You'll hear that quite a bit. The idea of the necessary being, the greatest conceivable being. God is that which is the greatest conceivable being. What we have done is kind of redefined it according to our illustrations. God is that which is above the arch. But that which is above the arch is by definition the greatest conceivable being. He is the one who exists beyond time. He is the one who is outside of creation, outside of time and space. There is nothing that he has to subscribe to. There is nothing that limits him. Time doesn't limit him. Space doesn't limit him. Matter does not limit him. He is beyond all of those things. Therefore, he is the greatest conceivable being. And so throughout the history of the church, while we have used the arch illustration, they have thought of it, but just in this term. He is the greatest conceivable being. And so Anselm would say that by definition, the greatest conceivable being has to exist. If he didn't exist, he's really not the greatest conceivable being. So I'm going to leave that with you all without making any real strong comments on it, other than it's very difficult. And there is a lot of literature that's written on it by people who, I don't know anybody who explains it really well, but
there's no easy illustrations in that one. There's no hole with a man jumping in or something like that.
Yeah. Here's the third way that it is sometimes expressed, not quite as accurate as the other ones, but maybe this will help you to get your arm around it just a little bit. If it can be conceived, it must exist. The concept of God is universally conceived, therefore God must exist.
We would explain that this way. Think of it this way. In science fiction, we have new creatures. So we have a three-headed monster. Well, understand that's just a combination of one-headed monsters with two more added, right? It's not a new thing. It's just recompiling that which already is. And so that's what premise one, if it can be conceived, it must exist. We can imagine a monster with five eyes, no problem. But we're still starting with the eye. We're only imagining things that already in fact exist, different orders, different arrangements, different numbers and all those things. Or we can imagine people with no noses. I mean, we can take parts out. But can we create something that doesn't exist? Can we imagine something? We can imagine impossibility. I mean, we can say, well, I mean, what would a four-sided triangle look like? But can we imagine something that has never been, in fact, in existence? I mean, we can imagine more eyes or less eyes, but can we imagine a new thing that's not an eye? A new thing that isn't representative of something else? And again, very, very hard to sort of put your arms around, but that premise one, can you imagine something, not a rearrangement of things that already exist, but something that doesn't? Let me give an example. If our world was black and white, and that's all we knew was black and white, and would we have the ability to imagine what color would be like? Well, probably not. I mean, it's hard to think about that way. But since our world is color, can you imagine, you know, that next thing? as color is to black and white, what would be that next thing? We can't imagine anything that in fact doesn't exist. We don't have that ability. All we can do is rearrange things that exist in different ways, whether they be plausible or not.
So the basic idea here is if there is the concept of God, then God must exist. Not an exact, and not really even what Anselm was stating, but sometimes this is called the ontological argument, the argument from being, ontos. If it is a being in your mind, it must exist in some form somewhere. Not saying that it's a good argument necessarily, but it's one just to have an understanding of.
This is my favorite one.
Teleological argument. This argument is probably the one most of you all are familiar with, and we talked about somewhat at the beginning whenever I said, why are you confident that he exists? And Mike said, you know, the order and complexity of the universe. Well, this speaks to that. That Greek word telos means end or complete. And this argument states that the order of the universe evidences intelligent design rather than chaotic chance. Therefore, there must be a designer. Paley's famous watchmaker illustration illustrates this best, I think, is if he was to say that if you were to be walking, or a man was to walk onto the moon and find a watch and pick it up, he wouldn't say to himself, wow, look at this, as I open it up, there's all these gears and mechanisms and springs and that sort of stuff, and hands and dials and numbers. It's really neat how this evolved, you know, without anybody behind it. He would say, nobody would ever think that, but yet a watch is so much less complex than what we find in creation. The simple cell is so much more complex than anything that we would ever find in creation. And so the teleological argument would say the argument from design or order. Ronald Nash says, while cosmological arguments for the existence of God deal primarily with the existence of the world, teleological arguments focus on the features of the existing world, notably its apparent order and design. Syllogism would be such as this. If there is a design, then there must be a designer. The universe in all its parts has design, therefore there must be an undesigned designer. Now notice the undesigned designer. You have to stop somewhere because an infinite series of designs and designers cannot be traversed. Notice how key that is. It comes up over and over again. The infinite series cannot be traversed. It has to start somewhere. Romans 1, 20 and 21 says this, For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that people are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. The idea is that the universe screams the existence of God in every part. This tells us that the nature of God, his divine nature and his eternal power are seen. His eternal power may be seen through how great the universe is, how powerful he must have been to create it. It's amazing how much more we know than Paul knew, huh? Creation screams at every point, whether it's the cell in your hand or the expanse of the universe. It screams a designer. It screams power. It screams a self-existing creator. It screams above the arch. It does. All of creation screams above the arch. Psalm 19, 1 through 4 says, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pour forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out throughout the whole earth, and their utterances to the end of the world, and he has placed a tent for the sun. In them he has placed a tent for the sun. Again, another one that tells us that then what we're doing here, again, is what's called philosophical theology. You remember us talking about this in the intro. This is a type of theology that we're not looking through the scriptures and saying, okay, here's syllogism one about the existence of God. Here's syllogism two. It's self-evident things that God has told us that say the heavens are screaming the glory of God. That they're not saying it audibly, but they're screaming it because
the author of the Psalms is assuming that our minds understand these principles that we're going through. The teleological argument, the cosmological argument. Next, the moral argument. This argument states that all people have a concept of right and wrong. This concept must have come from outside of them, a moral absolute. All people have a conscience. This conscience must reflect some conscience outside of them. Help me out with this one. This is the idea that there's moral absolutes that are principles that have guided all of time. It has always been right and always been wrong to do certain things, generally speaking. Now, a lot of people would object to this. This is very interesting, and I want you to hang with me because you're going to have somebody come up and say, I think this is a very, out of all the arguments so far, I think this is one of the most practical and the strongest. It is very difficult to overcome this. Many people would say, no, you're wrong, Michael, because there have been certain people throughout time who have held to different values, such as the Akua Indians, whenever Jim Elliot went there. How many people have read Through Gates of Splendor or one of those books? What was one of their values?
Spirit before your spirit.
Betrayal. Betrayal was a value. The basic idea is they looked excitedly upon another tribe member who did not do what was right according to our standards. You might be able to find examples of this throughout history. You might be able to go to certain tribes and certain times that believe that torture is good. I mean, I'm not saying you can, but you might. Now, people would say that just because you hold to this certain value system doesn't mean that everybody has. And so, therefore, this argument doesn't work out because not everybody has always had the same morals. And the idea of this argument is not that the exception creates the rule. Okay. Now, if the Akua Indians did not believe in the same value as we do about honesty, that doesn't cancel out all of history from the very beginning to now that 99.9% of the world has. But here's what I'm trying to express, is that even if somebody does bring up an argument, and you don't want to make it hinge upon whether you can prove the Akuas really did have the same value system as we do, because there can be anomalies, and this system still work. There can be anomalies in this moral argument still work, because you're dealing with all of people from all of time, and just because there's one person, how many people would agree that there's people out there, individuals, who would say that torturing innocent babies is good? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Do those exceptions provide the rule? No. We would not say that, oh, I guess that's all screwed up, the system is, because one person has, or a group of people have shown different values, therefore there is no common values that humanity has inherited. That's just totally wrong.
They don't defeat the rule either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The rule still exists.
The compelling part of the issue is that whether there are exceptions or not, that for so many people, over so many centuries, over so many different types of cultures and different types of lands, there is consistency. No one's trying to deny there might be some inconsistency in certain places, in certain times, possibly even in certain locations. Maybe it's location specific. But the dumbfounding part is so many people over so much time, there's so much consistency. It's look at the overwhelming amount of consistency. That's the thing that's compelling. Not the fact that did Charles Manson have a moral concept or anything? I don't know. But why does it seem that most Americans, for most of Americans' history, does? I don't know about Charles Manson. But why do most seem to do that? Why has most of civilization, for most of time, in most of the areas in the world, shown a consistency to, for example, our example of torturing babies, where they would all be against it?
And that's the primary example that's brought up always in this argument is torturing innocent babies, because most people would never say, oh, maybe that's right in a different culture. Most people would all say that's universally wrong, always. But if there's no God, it is not. It is not, because you would have to base that upon some principle. And if you base it upon nature and say survival of the fittest, then you'd have to say that survival is the ultimate good. But where do you get that from? Where does survival become good and death become bad? Once you have any type of system of right or wrong, good or bad, introduced at all,
you have something above the arch. You have a universal principle.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that. You see that there has to be something divine that is guiding the morality on the from the outside in, the right or wrongness. Otherwise, there is no reason for there to be universals. There may be reasons for there to be particulars of good and bad in this culture, that culture, this time and that time, but there's no universals whatsoever. There couldn't be universals unless there's something above the arch. Syllogism number one. Premise number one. Moral laws imply a moral lawgiver. There are universal, objective moral laws. Therefore, there must be a moral lawgiver. C.S. Lewis, really in his Mere Christianity, if you've ever read that, deals with this better than I think anybody has done in the 20th century in his first chapters of Mere Christianity. This is C.S. Lewis's exact statement if you wanted to read through it, but we're not going to go through that. Romans 2 says the same thing. Listen to this. Romans 2:14 says, "For when the Gentiles," listen to this, "when the Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having a law are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written on their hearts." Who wrote the work of the law on their hearts? God. "Their conscience," universal conscience, "bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them." So Romans 2 tells us that the moral argument for the existence of God is one that, you know, Paul uses here. If we were taking an apologetics course right now, we talk about the idea of what's called presuppositional apologetics, the apologetics of Francis Schaeffer, most Reformed theologians. What they would say is that everybody believes in God. Some people just deny that they believe in God. The idea here is that it's inconsistent. Well, let me ask you this. What's more important in your belief, the actions or the mindset? The actions or the confession? That's better. Actions. Francis Schaeffer would say everybody acts as if there's a God according to their morality, according to their right and wrongness. If they confess that they don't, makes no difference. Just like if you confess that you do, but you act like you don't, you're really a practical atheist. And so we would say that there are practical theists who confess that there is no God. So that would kind of answer your question in the sense that all people, and I'm not saying I believe this, but Francis Schaeffer would say this, that all people do actually believe in God based upon the way they understand right and wrong. The sensus divinitatis is the argument that everyone has an innate sense of the divine built within them. This God-shaped void causes them to have a great desire to fill the void by searching for God. To varying degrees, this argument has been held by Augustine, Calvin, and Pascal. And this is very subjective. Where's the evidence for this? Well, the evidence comes in the universal experience of God to some degree. And you may have heard it this way, that there's a God-shaped void in each one of us, and we try to fill that void with everything, and only God can fill it. And so evidence by the universal worshiping character, or need and desire to worship something within all of humanity. So it's an innate compass within us that is called the sensus divinitatis, the sense of the divine. We all have a certain sense of the divine. Syllogism, all people have an innate need for God, as evidenced by the universal religious experience. There must be someone, capital S, who created this need. Therefore, God must exist. St. Augustine put it this way, "For thou hast made us for thyself, and restless is our heart until it comes to rest in thee." Psalm 14:1 says, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Romans 1:20 assumes that they already knew of God. Doesn't say that they, even though they knew God. It doesn't mean that they had a personal experience with him, but they knew him, but they rejected him as God. Finally, Pascal's wager says this, that if there is, and this is, again, I put this here, I put all of these here not because I agree with them all equally, but because you need to know about them. Pascal's wager is another one of those that you need to know about, but one I think Rome likes it a little bit more than I do.
This is more of what you do in Las Vegas. This is not going to prove anything, but it's going to give you your odds. It's going to talk about what odds you're betting for or against. Whether you're right or wrong is relevant. The issue is it's based on the odds makers. It's a little bit like college football. So,
It says, if you say that there is a God and there is, if you say that there is not a God and there will be drastic consequences. If you say there is a God and there is not, you are none the worse. There are no consequences. Therefore, what should you do? You should believe in God. Now, that might be a good one if you've already looked at all the evidences or something, and then finally you come to this one. But if you're going to base your whole faith in God on this wager, and I think your faith is going to be very slim and probably won't hold up to many challenges, especially if your experience goes against your preconceived notions about God, especially whenever God is not answering your prayer.
One of the things that you might want to do to engage someone is to draw a circle and say, this represents all knowledge. This represents everything. How much of everything do you know? So you got a big circle, you know, there in front of you. How big a circle should I draw for your knowledge as to how much you know? And so it depends on how much they think they know. They might think they're real smart or whatever. But rarely would a person ask to fill most of that big circle in. They'd probably say half or a quarter or something, whatever they might say. And so you want to work, okay, if that's all you know and that's how much there is to be known, then what about all the things you don't know? And that's really what we're going with this whole wager idea, which is that, yeah, if you believe in God, in fact, the whole thing's false, you didn't lose anything. But if God is actually true and you're choosing not to believe in him simply because you don't know, or it's never been proven, or it's not, you know, it hasn't aligned with how you're thinking or your personal experience, then look at what you're betting against. That's really, look at the weight. Why not play it safe and bet that God probably does exist, even if you can or can't prove him, or even if it's compelling or not. Bet for him so that if you're wrong, you lose nothing, rather than betting against him and the possibility of being wrong. What are the consequences of being wrong, i.e. spending eternity in judgment? And so that's really the thing. And that's right, it may be just a way to engage a person. It really isn't convincing them of anything.
And maybe it's something after you present all of these
arguments. Or maybe it's after, yeah.
So what type of argument do you think would be best for each type of person? And let's just leave this rhetorical for right now. My purpose in this is that you would say the cosmological argument may be very good for certain people, but it may be terrible for others, may have no effect whatsoever. May have been very good for you and be a great cause for you, and might be for the next person. But for a lot of people, it's just going to be ineffective. More effective, I doubt there's too many people that the ontological argument's really going to be effective. Maybe if you go through the arch stuff beforehand and, you know, make sure they understand the arch theories, it might help. The teleological argument, you know, it's going to be for certain people, and for other people, may say, no, I like the moral argument or the cosmological. What point is there's going to be different types of people for each one of these. It's not as if there's one best argument out there, one all-conclusive argument, one that you can explain and you should have in your repertoire and use every single time. It's going to be different circumstances and different places, different for you. You hold on more tightly to some of these than others, and that's fine. What we would argue for is the cumulative case argument, the idea that all of these put together, my goodness, presents such a strong case for the existence of God. To go against and even to doubt his existence really becomes very irrational for us as humans. It goes against the grain of all of the evidence and says, I'm going to go into the realm of such strong doubt that in any other discipline, it would be called insanity, as we talked about last time. So we can say that the arguments for the existence of a God are extremely effective and extremely strong, especially whenever they're used in this cumulative case. Maybe no one argument is going to win anybody over, but use them all. They're very good arguments. They have great, rich history, and I think every one of them has something to say. Now, the key thing that I want you all to leave here with, though, is not only just an exposure to all of those things, but I want you to go home and dwell upon this for the next week, because it's probably the first time most of you have been introduced to the Kalam argument, the idea that an infinite number of moments cannot be traversed. A lot of these things will hinge upon that. And so I want you to think through that. How can an infinite number of moments be traversed? How can eternity go back into the past? And again, my very strong contention is that it cannot. It's an impossibility. Thank you.
Scene one, Apple, take one.